It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Words matter. If a patient walks into a clinic and he's got tuberculosis and we say, no, he's got the cold, take some aspirins, what's going to happen to that TB patient? He's going to die. Words matter. Why are we trying to score political points? The fact is, I'd like to give some different data. Forget about ISIS recruits in the Middle East. This man who did this attack is the 103rd ISIS terrorist suspect killed in America or captured in the last 2 years. 103, not jihadists, just ISIS. 2015, a report from Duke, 2015 saw the highest incidence of jihadi plots on U.S. territory since 9/11. The president can't admit his strategy has failed.
Sandy Rios with you. The world is turning hotter and hotter. There are more attacks around the globe, more attacks here at home. And I think people just in general are feeling the tension. Bangladesh, for certain, is feeling the tension after that terrible attack in a restaurant just a few days ago. Sebastian Gorka has been out fighting this. That was his voice we just heard as he's explaining on the airwaves day after day what's really going on. And he's doing it not only verbally, but through a new book that he just wrote called Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. And he joins us today. Welcome, Sebastian.
I think
the question is, honestly, the winnable war, is it possible, really, to defeat jihad, given how we have laid down our defenses and misnamed it and misfought it? Can we really win this?
Well, it's not possible now under the current leadership or lack of leadership in the United States. But if we have a new commander-in-chief who treats this as if this really is a war, understands the stakes involved, and that we have an implacable enemy that will not be negotiated with, but will have to be destroyed. Yes, it is eminently possible. We destroyed the Third Reich. We destroyed the Soviet Union. I think we can take care of 80,000 jihadis hanging out in Mesopotamia.
You know, Sebastian, we just went through the 4th of July, and I watched a PBS special, Capitol 4th on the lawn of the Capitol, which I absolutely love. And I think this year was the best I've ever seen. And I have to say, I get so discouraged. I know that all of us in this fight do. But as I saw the panoply of American beauty as they did a tribute to the parks, the national parks, and all of the talent and the Americans singing and waving their flags in that beautiful Capitol lawn, I was encouraged. And I thought to myself, how dare the jihadis think that they can walk into this country and take over these good people, the good people of the United States, so easily. It really does. It inspires incredulity, Sebastian, to think that they could have designs on the vastness of this country. Don't you think, really?
No, I don't, because I eat, breathe, and drink what they believe. That's what I get to do. I get to teach the mentality of the jihadi to our brave men and women in uniform and to our agents in the FBI. So, yeah, they, for them, it's not what they see on July 4th. Isn't the beauty of the greatest nation on God's earth? They don't see the dignity of the individual as enshrined in our founding documents and the principles laid down by the founding fathers. They see the infidel. They see individuals that represent the antithesis of their religion, and they see people who must be forcibly converted, enslaved, or killed. So, yeah, I appreciate their perspective a little bit differently because they are evil and they must be understood. They're not crazy people. They're not people, like in Orlando, they wanted to say that Omar Mateen had a crypto homosexual tendencies which were being suppressed and he had to take out revenge. No. It's nothing like that. It is the incarnation of evil. They are totalitarian and they hate us as much as the Soviets or the fascists did, probably even more. And that's what we have to understand if we wish to.
You know, that terrible attack in Bangladesh just a few days ago, that 10 hours of torture, people required, you know, to quote the Quran or be tortured and killed. What did we learn from that, Sebastian? What does that tell us about our enemy, other than the obvious?
Well, it tells us just how deeply committed they are to their vision. So the idea that, you know, what did the local police chief say in Dakar? He said, they're misrailed or misguided youth. No, they're not. They're people who have taken a conscious decision to be holy warriors for their God as they see it, and to build and help construct and expand the caliphate, the theocratic empire of Islam. If that, you know, requires torturing the infidel with knives and with swords as you hold them hostage in an Italian restaurant or whatever it was in the diplomatic quarter, then so be it. But this shouldn't surprise anyone. You know, they've crucified people who disagree with them. They decapitate people. They are now, as we speak right now, Sandy, ISIS is holding a slave market. They are selling Yazidi women as sex slaves for cash in the Middle East, because that's what they think of anybody who disagrees with them.
You know, as I was listening again to the 4th of July special, I have to just go back to this. I was listening to the orchestra. They played the 1812 Overture, Tchaikovsky's. They played John Philip Sousa marches. The chorus sang Smokey Robinson, you know, sang some of his hits from Motown. And I thought to myself, you know, Sebastian, as far as I know, the Islamic world does not produce art. I know they produce mosaics, but they don't have anything comparable to Western music or art, as far as I can tell. Am I wrong about that?
Look, there's a wonderful report published a few years ago by the United Nations, which is hardly a crypto-conservative race organization, called the Arab Human Development Report, and anyone of your listeners can download it. The Arab Human Development Report tells you about how seriously how the suffering, how the reality of culture in the Middle East affects the lives of billions of people. Look at the fact that, go to the Middle East and don't look for an Arab car. Try and find an Arab bicycle. You won't even find an Arab bicycle, one that's made in the region. These kinds of things are reflected in art as well. The Arab world translates fewer books into Arabic in 1 year than. So this is a statistic that really needs to be internalized. In the last century, the Arab world translated fewer foreign books into Arabic than Spain translated into Spanish last year. You need to internalize what that means for a culture. These are people who excised in their theology 1,000 years ago the concept of natural law, and for the last 1,000 years, they have been paying a price for that.
You know, it really is kind of amazing, and I'm going to do a sidebar. This is just my editorial comment. I just couldn't help but reflect on the fact that the God of the West, Jehovah, is a God of infinite creativity, created the world, the stars, the sun, the moon, human beings, life, the God of all creation, and how human beings created in his image reflect that. And it's, I just think it's very notable that the followers of Allah don't have that same creativity. And I just think it's something that I just found it very interesting. You know, in regard to...
Can I just stop you there for a second?
Sure.
You hit on something very important.
Yes.
So where does the concept of the role of the relationship between reason and revelation come from in Western civilization? What is the font of all natural law? It actually is driven back to what you just mentioned, the idea that our reason is a gift given to us because we are a reflection of the Creator. The idea in Islam, it's very specific, The idea that we are created in the image of God is utterly and totally blasphemous in Islam. That is heretical. And I think, that explains a lot of what we're seeing.
It really is something to think about, isn't it, Sebastian? And it goes really deep. And I think that kind of leads us into this whole discussion about one of the barriers to fighting Islam in the West, Islamic radicalism, is that Islam is, according to President Bush, one of the world's great religions. Now, I don't happen to agree with that, but it's like a protected class because we have a First Amendment right of freedom of expression, freedom of religion, so therefore we can't attack a religion. We can't criticize a religion. How do you, Sebastian Gorka, make that distinction?
Well, very simply, I start by saying there's no such thing as monolithic Islam. So I've worked very closely with our Muslim allies in the region, especially our Jordanian and Egyptian colleagues. And remember, what was the religion of the fighter pilot in the cage who was burnt alive by ISIS? He wasn't a Christian, he wasn't a Jew, he wasn't a Yazidi, he was a fellow Muslim. So, the Islam of Jordan is very different from the Islam of Saudi Arabia. So what we have to understand is that the 7th century atavistic and violent version of Islam is the one that is the problem, and especially because it's on the ascendant. It is rising. It is getting its adherence from, San Bernardino, California to Orlando, Florida. We have to be able to separate those who wish to be on our side as Muslims. And there are patriotic Muslims in the American Armed Forces, in the FBI. We have to empower them and make them the face of this war so that they can win it against people who have a very originalist 7th century interpretation of their religion.
Well, now, okay, Sebastian, you sound like Jay. I know you don't mean to, but I will say. You sound like Jay Johnson. That's what he said in his interaction with Senator Cruz.
I will
Cruz.
Take that personally, and I return that remark.
Yeah, I figured you should. But he's saying, we can't say anything bad about Islam because we have to work with our Islamic partners, and we can't use jihad, and we can't say Sharia, and we can't say taqiyya. He didn't say those things, but that's what he's talking about. We can't say these things because it's offensive to our Muslim partners. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, no, I completely disagree. Jay Johnson doesn't know what he's talking about. He should go back to being a highly paid lawyer who has nothing to do with national security. The fact is, I'm not saying you can't say a radical Islam. On the contrary, if you don't say radical Islam, you're actually weakening the Muslims who want to be our allies because they get it, they understand it. President Sisi of Egypt has said he is in a religious war to win back Islam from the jihadists. King Abdullah II of Jordan, likewise, he fully understands the religious context. It is people like Jay Johnson who want to deny completely who are actually endangering their fellow Americans.
Well, of course, the problem in America, as you well know, is the civilization jihad folk in the guise of the Muslim Brotherhood and their affiliates in CARE and the Islamic Society of North America and the Muslim Students Association and on it goes. These people are in the process of jihad, stealth jihad. And that's what makes it hard, Sebastian, because I think some are drawing a distinction between, or they seem unable to see that there's two different kinds of dangerous jihad. One is, strapping on a bomb and killing people, and the other is working from within to destroy us in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why self-education and understanding who the enemy is so essential, and that's why I wrote my new book, Defeating Jihad. The enemy knows that it's actually easier and cheaper not to have a frontal physical assault against us. So, going up against the United States militarily, that's not an easy task. But if you want to subvert a nation from the inside, the Roman Empire is a classic example of an empire, a powerful empire, subverted from the inside and
Sebastian,
taken down by people.
I'm going to interrupt you because we have to take a commercial break. Sebastian Gorka is our guest. The book is Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. We'll be back right after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Bangladeshi forces, guns drawn, surrounded the restaurant as police tried to negotiate the hostages' safe release. Residents taking cover nearby captured the moment the military stormed in. In the end, at least six militants were killed and 13 hostages rescued. But the counterattack didn't come quick enough. 20 civilians, mostly foreigners, were found brutally murdered. Emory College in Atlanta identified two of them as students. Abida Kaber was a Miami native. Her classmate Faraz Hussein was born in Bangladesh. Also killed in the attack, Tarishi Jain, a Berkeley student from India. The Spanish restaurant they were dining in is located in the normally safe diplomatic zone of Doha, popular with Westerners. Police say the 12-hour standoff began Friday night when at least seven gunmen entered the building and opened fire. Witnesses say the men shouted, "God is great," before detonating several explosives. Survivors who were injured were rushed to local hospitals in the back of pickups. This man's nephew was among those held hostage. They were able to communicate through text. "He told me to tell police they should not fire. If they fire, we will kill you," he said. It's unclear if his nephew was among those who survived or the many others who did not. ISIS was quick to claim responsibility. They released these photos of the alleged attackers less than 24 hours after the chaos began. According to the military, one of the terrorists was captured alive and is being questioned. Rena, along with the civilian deaths, two police officers were also killed.
All right, that was a CBS report on what happened in Bangladesh just a few days ago. My guest is Sebastian Gorka, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Sebastian, we just came through Ramadan, which is the big Muslim celebration, and there were a lot of threats. There were threats to blow up, to attack airports in, I believe, New York. They talked about Los Angeles. They talked about London. Were you surprised? I know Saudi Arabia had, like, I think, three suicide attacks, and there were certainly some horrible things that happened in Iraq. But nothing really in the West. Did that surprise you?
It did. I did. I mean, the terrorists are always looking for symbolic, not just only symbolic targets, but also symbolic dates. And July 4th in America would have been very attractive to them. So, yeah, it did actually surprise me, Sandy.
Yeah. Before we took the break, I interrupted your thought because you were talking about how the Roman Empire was defeated from within and making comparisons to what stealth jihad is attempting to do here. So let me let you finish your thought.
Yeah, so the enemy, the jihadists, understand that America is the most powerful nation the world has ever seen. So, you know, they can attack us in individual instances, atrocities such as Orlando and elsewhere. But the fact is, it may be much easier for them to get what they wish to achieve through the undermining of our value system, the subversion of our democratic order. So, you know, we know from the Holy Land Foundation trial, the biggest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history, that the enemy, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, has front organizations, has entities in the United States who are committed to the same goal as the violent jihadis, but are using non-kinetic, non-physical means to achieve it. So, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And if I can use subversion, if I can use influence, then that may be the way to go if you're a jihadi.
Sebastian, I think the first time I ever interviewed you, we talked at least to some degree about your folks, your parents. You were born in Hungary. Your parents were born in Hungary, and they escaped in 1956 during the Hungarian Revolution, which is, I know to many people, kids don't even know, can't even name a senator now or tell us why we have a 4th of July. So I don't expect them to understand the Hungarian Revolution, but it was a sad time in American history, I'll tell you, when we failed to help the Hungarians. But it was all about communism and freedom. And so deep within you and in your DNA is the knowledge of the destructive, potentially destructive forces, including communism and now Islamism. And so you actually, in your book, get into the similarities or things that we can learn from some of the stuff we learned during the Soviet era. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, so Defeating Jihad is built very much on my family's experiences, having escaped the communist dictatorship and how the West won the war against Karl Marx and the Kremlin. So the fact is, when I saw the events of September the 11th, I think I appreciated them differently from my fellow Americans. With parents, with a father who'd actually escaped from a communist political prison. For me, the events of September the 11th represented one thing. The totalitarians have returned. The enemy we face today are just as totalitarian as Hitler was, just as totalitarian as Karl Marx or Brezhnev or Stalin. The only difference is they have this religious overlay, that they're not doing it for the working class or for some Aryan, you know, ethnically pure empire. They're doing it for their God. And as a result, the similarities with how we won and dealt with the Cold War are very important. And that's why my book really builds upon the idea that the ultimate victory in this war will not come from killing terrorists. Killing terrorists is okay, but that's not how we win. We win this war when we delegitimize the enemy's message, the same way we delegitimized the ideology of the Soviet Union.
Sebastian, let's go back to the point we were trying to make earlier. And, you know, some people would say that Islam is like communism. It is a political system. A communism was an atheistic system. Islam has an element of religion, but a very small element. Mostly it's Sharia law. And that Sharia law is what is manifesting itself in the world. It's hardcore Islam in the very text and theology of Islam. So how does a Western world make a distinction between a political system that goes by a religious name and uses a god thrown in the mix and a political system like we're clear about fighting communism? We're not so clear about fighting Islamism.
Well, you know, I'll start by rejecting what you said. Again, I will say there is no such thing as monolithic Islam. I mean, I have trained the majority of the senior special forces for the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And they're Muslims, and I stand in a trench right now and lay my life and risk my life and put my life in the hands of any of those Muslims. So, you know, to say Islam is X or Islam is Y means you haven't traveled the Muslim world. It means that you don't know the difference between Bangladesh and Indonesia, that you don't know the difference between Jordan and Pakistan. I want to see the Jordanian Islam. Be the popular one. I want to see the Egyptian Islam be the one that is fashionable, the one that wants to be friends with us is the one we have to support. The version that ISIS or Al-Qaeda is representing is a supremacist religion that's as political as it is religious, and it's globalist and it's totalitarian. That's the version that we have to defeat with our Muslim allies. And I think that level of sophistication can be managed by most Americans.
You know what? I don't know. I don't know, Sebastian. That even seems more complex. When it comes to trying to explain to Americans that the First Amendment applies to everyone, the freedom to worship how you want, when you want, and then trying to surveil a mosque because people are being taught, you know, jihad in a mosque, you know, in some mosques, That's a very hard line to walk.
No, it's not. It's very simple, incredibly simple. Being in a place of worship doesn't protect you if you are subversive. I don't care whether you're going into a church, an ashram, or a Jewish temple. If you are doing things that are counter the Constitution of the United States, you are a threat. So this isn't rocket science. Isn't brain surgery. If I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan, if I'm intent on lynching my fellow Americans because they have the wrong skin color, walking into a church does not protect me. If I'm a Jewish extremist, if I'm a member of one of the fundamentalist sects that doesn't recognize the creation of Israel and wants to kill the Israeli prime minister, walking into a temple does not protect me from the security services. The same goes for a jihadi. The trouble is we have politicians who think it does, who think that walking into a mosque means the FBI or the NYPD has to switch off their microphone. The problem is with the politician, not the American people and not the U.S. Constitution.
All right, Sebastian, in the few minutes that we have left, you say, again, this is a winnable war. Defeating jihad, it's a winnable war. Just give us a brief idea, a sketch of how we might win this war.
Absolutely. So my book, The Feeding Jihad, is based upon three very simple things that I recommend to whoever the next president of the United States will be. Number one, we have to get politics, and especially political correctness, out of the threat assessment. This whole idea that politicians or cabinet members are allowed to, you know, censor and prohibit the use of certain language. You know, the attorney general redacting what the terrorist actually said in Orlando to the 911 dispatcher. Words like jihad being banned from counterterrorism training in federal government. That has to end. That must be jettisoned. No censorship, no political correctness. The second, we have to empower our Muslim allies. Look, the fact is the majority of people being killed by the jihadis are Muslims. This is important to understand. They want to kill us, Christians and Jews and Yazidis and Hindus, but by far the greatest victims are Muslims. So we have to help those Muslims who are being targeted take the fight to groups like ISIS, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Sunnis of Iraq, and the Kurds. They have to create a coalition to fight and destroy ISIS, but that's never going to happen without America's support. So America has to rebuild all the bridges that Obama has destroyed in the last 7 years in the Middle East in terms of relationships with our Muslim allies. And then lastly, the thing I mentioned before, long-term victory, the strategic success, will come when we use counter propaganda to destroy the brand of jihad, if you will, to delegitimize the ideology of global jihadism. The same way we did with communism, that is when then as a nation, we will be safe. Those three things together, we can win this war.
Sebastian, one last thing. We have a presidential election coming up, and you actually comment on what questions to ask or what answers to look for from the candidates. Just briefly, that, and then I'll let you go.
Well, look, after Director Comey's recent press conference, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton should be dropped by the Democrat Party. She's clearly not fit for office, given what she did with classified material. But if you just want general questions, you know, I've advised Donald Trump in the past, I'm not on his campaign, but whoever you're talking about, simply ask them very simple questions. Who do you think we are at war with? Okay, I want to know who you think it is. Is it people who are unemployed and disenfranchised, or is it jihadis? Do you believe in the existence of evil? If you don't, then what do you think beheading of people because they have the wrong passport, what does that represent? And then just thirdly, what is your plan for securing America? Is it more of the same? Is it repeating the last 7.5 years of catastrophic national security policies? Or do you have a better plan? Those are the three most important questions that I would expect to have answers from our next commander-in-chief.
All right. The book is called Defeating Jihad. It's the Winnable War. And Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the author. And Sebastian, we do appreciate the way you have been all over the airwaves, just slugging away, trying to inform
Thank
the
you.
Public. And I think you're having
Thank
a great
you.
Effect. So thanks, Sebastian. God bless you. All right, Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Interesting discussion with Sebastian Gorka in his new book, Defeating Jihad. Last week, there was a hearing that we never really got to spend as much time with as I wanted to. You know, Senator Cruz, many people have asked, what's he doing? He's back in the Senate. That must be very difficult. Can you imagine? I'm sure it is. But I have to tell you that he has chosen to focus his energies and all of his resources on the issue of jihad in America and countering what this administration is doing in terms of scrubbing manuals and making us absolutely ill-prepared to fight what we must fight. So Senator Cruz, in a hearing last week, was questioning Jay Johnson, the head of Homeland Security. And I wanted you to hear this exchange because I think it's very important. So here is Senator Ted Cruz with Secretary Jay Johnson of Homeland Security. Let's listen.
On Tuesday of this week, this committee's oversight subcommittee conducted a hearing on the systematic scrubbing of law enforcement and intelligence materials. Your department was invited to attend, and the Department of Homeland Security refused to attend the hearing. At that hearing, we heard testimony that described a systematic effort. If one compares, for example, the 9/11 Commission report, the word jihad appears in that report 126 times, the word Muslim appears in that report 145 times, the word Islam appears in that report 322 times. And yet, since that 9/11 Commission report, different policies have come into effect. And as a matter of systematic policy, those terms are no longer allowed to be used in this administration. The FBI counterterrorism lexicon uses the word jihad 0 times. The National Intelligence Strategy of 2009 uses the word jihad 0 times. The Strategic Implementation Plan to Prevent Violent Extremism of 2011 uses the word 0 times. The National Intelligence Strategy in 2014 uses the word 0 times. We also heard testimony from a former employee of the Department of Homeland Security, Phil Haney, that in October 2009, more than 800 Customs and Border Patrol documents were ordered modified, scrubbed, or deleted to remove references to jihad or the Muslim Brotherhood or other similar references. Was Mr. Haney's testimony that the Department of Homeland Security ordered over 800 documents in CBB altered or deleted, was that testimony accurate?
I have no idea. I don't know who Mr. Haney is. I wouldn't know him if he walked in the room.
So you have not investigated whether your department ordered documents to be modified in 2009 to remove references to jihad, radical Islamic terrorism, the Muslim Brotherhood? You have not investigated that question?
No, I have not taken the time to investigate what Mr. Haney says, no.
And when the United States Senate Judiciary Oversight Committee conducted a hearing on that, did you or anyone in your staff inquire into those issues?
No, but you have me right here, right now, to ask questions of. So
but apparently your answer is you don't know. I am asking you, in 2009 and again in 2012, Mr. Haney testified there were 2 purges, and that was the word he used, purge, at the Department of Homeland Security to remove references to radical Islamic terrorism. Is it accurate that the records were changed?
Same answer I gave you before. I have no idea, sir.
You have no knowledge of any records being changed at the Department of Homeland Security?
Same answer. I have no idea, sir.
Would it concern you if it was accurate?
Well, that's interesting, and so we'll let it hang for a second. Remember, Phil Haney was on with us last week, and in his new book, See Something, Say Nothing, he talked about how they scrubbed all of his information. He was making all these connections with radical Islamists, and he said that it was the same root of radical Islam that the people in San Bernardino, the killers there, were connected to. The same root of Islam that manifested itself in the Orlando shooter and the mosque down there. And Philip Haney said he could have connected those dots, but they scrubbed his information. They so punished him that they made him spend the last 9 months of his time at Department of Homeland Security at a desk without any security clearance and any access. They took away his gun. They completely shut him out from the information that he was gathering. But Jay Johnson has never heard of Mr. Haney, he said. And, you know, he's too busy to concern himself with such things. Well, Senator Cruz goes on with the questions.
Senator, I find this whole debate to be very interesting, but I have to tell you, when I was at the Department of Defense giving the legal sign-off on a lot of drone strikes, I didn't particularly care whether the baseball card said Islamic extremist or violent extremist. I think this is very interesting, but it makes no difference to me in terms of who we need to go after, who is determined to attack our homeland. The other point I'd like to make, sir, is that, and I have to think in practical terms in Homeland Security, I think this is all very interesting, makes for good political debate, but in practical terms, if we, in our efforts here in the homeland, start giving the Islamic State the credence that they want to be referred to as part of Islam or some form of Islam, we will get nowhere in our efforts to build bridges with Muslim communities, which we need to do. in this current environment right now that includes homegrown violent extremists. They all tell me that ISIL has hijacked my religion, and it's critical that we bring these people to our side to do this.
You're entitled to give speeches other times. My question was if you were aware that the information has been scrubbed. I would note the title of the hearing on Tuesday was Willful Blindness, and your testimony to this full committee now is that you have no idea and apparently have no intention of finding out DHS materials have been scrubbed. And you suggested just a moment ago that it's essentially a semantic difference. Well, I don't believe it is a semantic difference, that when you erase references to radical jihad, it impacts the behavior of law enforcement and national security to respond to red flags and prevent terrorist attacks before they occur.
Remember that the whole push for homeland security for this administration and its countering violent extremism is to just talk about extremism. All violent extremism is the same. And also making the point, they do all the time, that domestic terrorism groups like, potential Tea Party activists, people coming back from the military who have served, people like, they use skinheads a lot. I actually think they use that description when it isn't even warranted. But they are just as dangerous, according to Homeland Security, as any jihadist. And so they want to use this very large umbrella countering violent extremism because they do not want to put the focus where the focus belongs. Goes on, let's listen to the next part where Senator Cruz lays out the problem with not identifying it.
Let's take Nidal Hassan. Nidal Hassan, the Obama administration was aware he was communicating with Anwar al-Awlaki, a known radical Islamic terrorist. The Obama administration was aware that Nidal Hassan had inquired of Anwar al-Awlaki the permissibility of waging jihad against his fellow soldiers. And yet the administration did not act, and Nidal Hassan walked through Fort Hood in my home state of Texas, murdering 14 innocent souls, yelling, Aloha Akbar. Do you think it was a mistake not to respond to those red flags ahead of time and prevent the terrorist attack at Fort Hood?
I disagree with your factual predicate. Those are not the facts.
What do you disagree with?
I disagree with your factual predicate.
What specifically do you disagree with, sir?
In 1 minute, I couldn't possibly answer your question.
Pick anything.
It was wrong in a number of respects.
Pick one thing, sir.
First of all, you're assuming that the federal government, in advance of the attack on Fort Hood, saw all these different red flags. That's not correct.
So are you testifying to this committee? Let's take the facts I introduced one piece at a time. You are an experienced attorney, number one. Was it true or false the Obama administration knew before the attack that Nidal Hassan was communicating with Anwar al-Awlaki?
Well, how are you defining the Obama administration, sir?
The Federal Bureau of Investigation.
The entire Federal Bureau of Investigation. I can't answer that question sitting here.
Okay, the answer is yes, and it is in public record, sir.
I can't answer the question.
All right, let's take another example. We have similar examples of red flags. The Zarnaev brothers. Mm-hmm. Russia informed the United States they were affiliated with radical Islamic terrorism. We interviewed the elder Zarnaev brothers. The Department of Homeland Security missed when the elder Zarnaev brother went to Chechnya and met with radical Islamic terrorists. The administration missed when there was a public posting of the elder Zarnaev brother calling for jihad. And in the Boston bombing, they set off pressure cookers, murdering 3 people and wounding roughly 180. Was it a mistake not to respond more effectively to those red flags and prevent that act of radical Islamic terrorism?
I disagree with some of what you said, but I do believe that there were some lessons learned from that episode, sir. And I believe that as a result, we are doing a better job of connecting all the right dots.
Really? Really? Jay Johnson believes as long as he believes they're doing a better job, I guess it doesn't matter what the reality shows, that we are having an outbreak of attacks in the United States, and they are doing really very little to stop it. I think a lot of FBI agents and people inside are doing their best, but they can't connect the dots. We just heard, Phil Haney, he was the one researching the connection between these groups. All of those connections have been erased. How in the world are they supposed to do detective work, link, connect the dots, if those dots have been erased? But Jay Johnson says he thinks they're doing a good job, so that's all that matters, as long as he thinks so. I wonder if the people of Orlando would agree with him, the ones in the nightclub, the loved ones of those that were killed in that nightclub. And so Senator Cruz then goes into his last question, because he only has 10 minutes with Jay Johnson, and this is how he ends it.
But Mr. Secretary, the concern, and my time is expiring, so this will be my final question. The concern is this pattern of failing to connect the dots keeps occurring over and over and over again. It occurred in San Bernardino when the female terrorist gave a fake address in Pakistan, and yet the administration failed to discover that. It occurred in Orlando, where the terrorist was interviewed three times, has pledged his allegiance to Al-Qaeda and to Hezbollah, had what was an associate of the first American suicide bomber in Syria, and yet we didn't act to prevent it. And what concerns me, and I believe should concern the Department of Homeland Security, is that because of this effort, scrubbing your law enforcement materials of any acknowledgement of radical Islamic terrorism, when you see the red flags of radical Islamic terrorism, you do not follow up on them effectively, and we have terrorist attack after terrorist attack after terrorist attack that could have been prevented but for this administration's willful blindness.
First of all, virtually every day, I read about the good work of our law enforcement personnel, our Homeland Security personnel, and our intelligence community connecting the dots to identify potential terrorist plots on our homeland, irrespective of the label you want to put on it. I think our people are smart enough to identify somebody who is a violent extremist, who is self-radicalizing, who is moving toward violence, when there are some warning signs, like somebody who sees somebody buying a gun or training or buying weapons of explosive material. Every day I see people connecting the dots across our law enforcement, Homeland Security, intelligence communities. Are there lessons learned? Could we do a better job? The answer is probably yes. But every day I see this happening, and I think we are doing a better job, and I think that our people are smart enough to identify potential terrorist behavior, whether you call it Islamic or extremist or anything else. I think the labels, frankly, are less important, except where we need to build bridges to American Muslim communities and not vilify them so that they will help us help them. That is my answer to your question, sir.
You know, I just wonder if it's okay with Jay Johnson if we vilify Tea Party members, or if we vilify returning vets, or if we vilify the American Family Association, you know, as listed by the SPLC as a hate group. Is it okay if we vilify? It's okay to offend those kind of people, but not Muslims, not the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial, which is a supporter of Hamas, linked at the hip with a terrorist organization. But we wouldn't want to offend our friends who are in the Council of Islamic Relations. And by the way, that brings me to another point, which I've made before, but I shall repeat. Michael McCaul, Homeland Security Chairman for the House, working together with CARE in Dallas-Fort Worth, friends, and, of course, pushing through this countering violent extremism program, which is a completely fake program, which the House is, maybe some of them actually believe it's fighting radical Islam. But no one who's paying any attention to what this countering violent extremism program and actually fighting jihad really believes, it's effective. There's rottenness at the core of countering violent extremism. And that's why so many of us have been fighting the Congress supplying any more money, because that money, according to the program, is supposed to go to our Muslim outreach, CARE, and the Islamic Society of North America, and all those friendly Muslim groups in the United States, which are actually connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, which Senator Cruz, by the way, has been trying for a long time in the Senate to get declared as a terrorist group. Egypt certainly has declared them a terrorist group and cannot believe that the United States does not consider them such. They are the ones who have advocated for the overthrow of the United States through stealth jihad. And so, but hey, they're friends to Michael McCaul, and they're friends to Jay Johnson, and they're friends to this president of the United States. And so they must be friends with Loretta Lynch, too, because she gets, you know, all in a huff and teary when she thinks about saying anything that might hurt their feelings. You know, one of the key premises of this countering violent extremism is that they say that violence is a problem and we must focus on it alone, when the truth is Sharia is the problem. And those who seek its imposition through stealthy, pre-violent techniques, you know, they're not strapping bombs on themselves, but this is pre-violence. They are enemies, the same as violent jihadists. Islam is a religion of peace, says the Countering Violent Extremism curriculum. Those who engage in violence in its name are seeking to pervert or hijack a great religion. But authorities of Islam declare Sharia to be the truth faith. They regard non-adherent Muslims as perverters of Islam and apostates deserving death. And on we could go. And so we must be smart about what we do. If it takes the American people to overcome this, then so be it. Then we will educate ourselves and arm ourselves and protect ourselves, and we will force this government to do what is right, either through the election box or whatever we have to do to protect our people and our citizens and our children. That's what we're going to have to do. Thanks to Sebastian Gorka. And again, his book is called Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. This has been Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.